Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Religious Liberties Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, August 28, 2012, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of the Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, our call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we're happy to welcome Kyle Duncan to give us an update on litigation challenging the HHS contraceptive mandate, which went into effect on August 1st of this year. Mr. Duncan joined the Beckett Fund as general counsel in January 2012 after serving as Solicitor General and Appellate Chief of the Louisiana Department of Justice. He's taught constitutional law at the University of Mississippi Law School, served on the Texas Attorney General's office, and he's been in private practice with the Vincent and Elkins Law Firm in Houston, Texas. His longer bio is made available to you in the notice of this call. So without further, Mr. Duncan, please go right ahead with your opening remarks.
Thank you, Dean. Thank you, Federalist Society, for having me on this call, and thanks to everyone for calling in. I should mention, in the interest of full disclosure, that the organization I work for, the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty, represents five of the plaintiffs in these lawsuits that I'm about to describe for you. So what I'd like to do is give an overview of the litigation surrounding the Health and Human Services mandate. It has really taken on extraordinary dimensions since it began. This litigation began in November of 2011, to the point where it's safe to say it's one of the most notable, if not the most notable, collection of lawsuits challenging a federal regulation as violating religious liberty really in the history of our nation. So in order to do that, I want to give a thumbnail sketch of the mandate itself fairly quickly, and then give a quick overview of the litigation and concentrate on a couple of recent decisions that we have seen that are noteworthy. So first, a thumbnail sketch of the mandate itself. The Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, which everyone is familiar with, has in it a provision that mandates that all group health plans and health insurance issuers cover something the Affordable Care Act calls preventive care and services. Yet the ACA doesn't define what preventive care and services are. And so following the passage of the Act in 2010, by regulation, this term preventive care and services was defined to include, quote, all FDA-approved contraceptive drugs and sterilization methods. This includes so-called emergency contraceptives, such as the morning-after pill and the week-after pill that the FDA itself describes as preventing the implantation of a fertilized egg. And, of course, many people consider that to be tantamount to an abortion. Now, this regulation, promulgated on August 1, 2011, became effective this year as of August 1, 2012. The regulation does include an exemption for, quote, religious employers. This exemption was also promulgated by regulation. Without getting too much into the details, there's a four-part test to determine who qualifies as a religious employer, but it's a very narrow definition, and it basically applies only to houses of worship, churches, church auxiliaries, and the like, as defined by the Internal Revenue Code. Finally, the mandate is enforceable in three ways. For employers who have 50 or more employees, they are, of course, mandated by the ACA, by the Affordable Care Act itself, to offer employee health insurance, which includes the preventive care mandate. If they do not do so, then they have to pay an assessment of $2,000 per employee per year. Second, if an employer offers health insurance and the insurance does not include the preventive services, the mandated contraceptive and sterilization services, then that employer is subject to an IRS penalty of $100 per day per employee. And third and finally, as for the enforcement measures, the ACA is incorporated into ERISA, and so the ACA authorizes ERISA lawsuits by plan participants and beneficiaries to enforce the terms of the preventive care mandate. So that's a thumbnail sketch of the mandate. Getting to the litigation, federal lawsuits began to be brought against the mandate back in November of 2011. The Beckett Fund was actually the first to bring those lawsuits. And now there are over 25 lawsuits across the nation pending on behalf of over 80 plaintiffs. The plaintiffs are represented by Beckett Fund and also other nonprofit groups such as ADF, ACLJ, Thomas More Society, and also the Jones Day Law Firm represents a large number of the Catholic plaintiffs. Most of the plaintiffs are, I should mention that if you go to the Beckett Fund website, you can find an interactive map that will show you exactly where all the lawsuits have been brought and who the plaintiffs are, with links to the complaints. As an overview, most of the plaintiffs in these cases are nonprofit organizations such as universities, charitable associations, archdioceses, high schools. So you have the Universities of Notre Dame, Catholic University of America, Ave Maria University in Florida. You have the archdioceses of the District of Columbia, of New York, among others. You have a number of Catholic high schools. You have the largest Catholic broadcasting network in the world called EWTN as a plaintiff. Some of the nonprofit plaintiffs are evangelical Protestants, however, objecting not to contraceptives in general, but to the abortion-inducing contraceptives included under the mandate. And finally, a few of the plaintiffs are business owners whose owners are motivated by their faith to bring lawsuits against the mandate. The claims in general that have been brought in these lawsuits are under the Free Exercise Clause, the Establishment Clause, and the Free Speech Clause of the First Amendment. The Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which is a federal statute protecting protecting religious liberty in a greater measure than the First Amendment does, and also the Administrative Procedures Act. Getting to a couple of specifics that I'd like to highlight, and then I'll turn it over for questions. The status of these lawsuits, most of them are still in the motion to dismiss phase. The federal government is arguing that the plaintiffs in many of these cases lack standing and ripeness. Why is the government arguing that? Because soon after the controversy erupted over the mandate, the government put in place a safe harbor, a one-year temporary non-enforcement safe harbor for many religious organizations that don't qualify for the exemption. And during that safe harbor, the government has promised, the government has issued an advance notice of proposed rulemaking that promises, in essence, to fix the mandate by August 1st of 2013. The government hasn't yet issued a notice of proposed rulemaking, however. Two federal district judges in the District of Columbia have agreed with the government that those measures make the lawsuits unripe for organizations that are covered by the safe harbor, and that's in the Belmont Abbey case and the Wheaton College case. I'll say a couple more words about Wheaton as I close. A few plaintiffs, however, are clearly not subject to the safe harbor because they're business owners. And so they've sought preliminary injunctions. So you have Hercules Industries in Colorado, represented by ADF, and Frank O'Brien and O'Brien Industrial Holdings in Missouri, represented by ACLJ. They've sought PIs. The safe harbor and the government's promise to fix the mandate doesn't apply to for-profit businesses. So finally, just very quickly, two notable decisions that we've seen so far. The first is a very positive decision in the Hercules case, which is in federal court in Colorado. This is a lawsuit in which a business owner, a Catholic business owner, is represented by ADF. They sought a preliminary injunction, and the district court in Colorado granted it. Of note, the government in that case argued that a for-profit secular business cannot, by definition, engage in religious exercise. And the court didn't resolve that question on preliminary injunction, but it did say it found it a difficult question of first impression. The court also rejected the government's arguments on compelling interest and least restrictive means, saying essentially that the government had already made a number of exemptions for other employers, and so the government couldn't claim to have a compelling interest in not exempting this employer or employers like this employer. And the court also found the government failed to refute the argument that the government really could adopt a far less restrictive means and provide contraceptives directly, which, of course, it already does. And finally, the Wheaton decision, which is an evangelical college that the Beckett Fund represents, Wheaton, for technical insurance reasons, did not qualify for the safe harbor. And so it brought a lawsuit and sought a preliminary injunction. And interestingly enough, the government immediately reacted by expanding the safe harbor to include Wheaton and similarly situated organizations, which caused the court then to dismiss the lawsuit as unripe. So with that, I will turn it over to questions. I'm happy to answer your questions, and then at the end, perhaps I'll wrap up a little bit.
Terrific. Thank you so much. Kyle, let me ask you, in the Bush administration, and sometimes I think in the Obama administration as well, we've seen involvement in some, I don't know how they style them, maybe some of the more significant or perceived to be important cases by the Solicitor General's office at the appellate court level and sometimes even at the trial court level. Has there been any involvement in any of these cases by the Solicitor General?
That's a good question. I mean, we definitely saw involvement at the Solicitor General's office at the circuit level in the challenges to the individual mandate. Here, we have not yet seen that. We've seen the DOJ attorneys from federal programs handling the case. We've seen the same group of lawyers in all of our five cases, and I can't speak to the other cases, but we have not seen any involvement as of yet by the Solicitor General's office.
Okay. And in terms of next steps and how these cases are progressing, I mean, they're all over the country, I take it.
They are.
Do you hope to prevail in every one of these cases? Do you hope to trigger a circuit split? Are you able to answer that question?
I think it's safe to say when you see cases brought all over the country in different venues like this, one obvious hope is for there to be a circuit split. I mean, certainly everyone hopes to prevail in their cases. But as you can see, you have some courts going one way, some courts going the other on preliminary procedural issues. I think it's within the realm of reason to say you'll see courts maybe going both ways on the merits when some or most of these cases get to the merits. Having said that, we would not be shocked to see when courts reach the merits of these claims, particularly the claim under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, you know, we feel very strongly that these are solid arguments. The few times that the government has now had to respond on the merits, for instance, in the Hercules decision, it's difficult not to note how weak the government's responses have been. That's why I highlighted the government's argument that a for-profit business cannot engage in religious exercise by definition. So when the cases get to the merits, we hope and we strongly believe you'll see favorable decisions on the merits. Having said that, naturally it's possible for cases like this to get to the U.S. Supreme Court eventually.
Right. Now, is it your expectation that these cases would get to appeal and maybe even the Supreme Court on some of those procedural or jurisdiction or standing issues before they get to merits? In other words, are these cases going to go up, come back down on those issues before a merits claim reaches an appellate level?
That's possible, Dean. We imagine that you'll see courts going different directions on the procedural issues. The procedural issues are very difficult. The standing and rightness issues are very difficult. The government has, I mean, as you can tell from my comments, the government has, in a sense, changed the rules of the game as the litigation has gone along. The government has offered now three different interpretations of the safe harbor provision. It changed the safe harbor in direct response to the Wheaton lawsuit and the federal district judge recognized that in her opinion. So you're going to see different decisions. The timing is a little tricky on these things because, you know, you have courts judging whether the lawsuits are ripe, and it's impossible to say. I mean, it's impossible to say what the government is going to do. I mean, the government has, all it's done at this point is say, look, we're going to fix this thing at some point by August 2013. The government's not bound to do that. The government hasn't said what exactly it's going to do. It's floated some ideas that seem patently unhelpful or impossible to implement. But it's difficult to say what the courts are going to do. I mean, we've had for our purposes, I can tell you that cases we have had motions to dismiss fully briefed for quite some time now, and we've gotten no decisions on them. Who knows what's happening with those? But I mean, you know, to directly answer your question, sure, we could see different decisions from different courts and have to go up procedural questions and go back down.
Okay. It's an interesting dynamic, the notion that the government is relying on the argument that there's a cure in the works. Have you encountered anything like that before in litigation?
Yeah, I haven't. Obviously, the government is entitled to some presumption of good faith, but it's a very strange series of events because, you know, what you had is you had the mandate rolled out, and of course the government waived notice and comment when it rolled out the regulation and put in the mandate as an interim final rule. And then you've got a lot, you know, public controversy surrounds it. You know, you have press conferences by the Secretary of HHS. You have press conference by the President of the United States. And at that point, the government starts sort of putting in place different sort of firewall mechanisms, so to speak. So you have the government comes up with a religious employer exemption. And so by regulation, the government exempts out certain organizations, but it's extremely narrow. Somebody said, the exemption is so narrow it wouldn't have applied to Jesus Christ or Mother Teresa, because you know, not only do you have to be a house of worship, essentially under the Internal Revenue Code, but you have to primarily serve and hire only people who share your own faith. It's a very, very narrow definition of what constitutes a religious employer. So the government rolls that out, and then there's more controversy over the scope of that, and the government puts in place this safe harbor, which is sort of a tier three protection. So if you don't qualify for the employer, the religious employer exemption, then you get this sort of temporary safe harbor where the government says, well, the mandate still applies to you, but we're just not going to enforce it against you for a year. And so the government has, in our view, been moving the goalposts, and it makes it very tricky to know how to litigate it and tricky to anticipate what's going to happen.
Yeah, now, if I understand you correctly, and obviously correct me if I'm wrong on this, it seems to me there's a tension between the positions of the government here when they're asserting prospectively that they'll make a fix. There's a tension between that litigation position and what I understand to be the actions of the Administrative Procedure Act, that there's a rulemaking procedure with a notice for public hearing and comment and no predetermined result or no predetermined outcome from that process. Otherwise, the public comment becomes a meaningless exercise. Are they guaranteeing an outcome in that process, and is that in tension with the Administrative Procedure Act? Have you looked at that angle of things?
I mean, we certainly think it is. I mean, surely the whole premise of notice and comment is to meaningfully consider the ramifications of a proposed rule. However, when the government has had comments, and government received almost 200,000 comments on the religious employer exemption, many, many, many of which were saying, this is just too narrow. The government didn't do anything in response to it. It just left the definition exactly as it had promulgated before. Now, this new round of rulemaking, I mean, if you can even call it that, it's not a notice of proposed rulemaking. It's an advance notice. And the government seems to us, as we've said in our pleadings, to be taking contradictory positions. Because the government is saying, look, we are not changing the mandate. We are not changing the religious employer exemption. What we're going to do is figure out, it says, an alternate way of routing free contraceptives to the employees of religious organizations. And so it floats ideas about forcing an insurer to provide contraceptives directly to employees. Now, on its face, that is sort of non-responsive to the claims in these cases. I mean, the claims are that if at least on behalf of our clients, is that if a religious employer is facilitating access to drugs that violate its faith, then it can't do that. Well, the fix that the government has proposed would still amount to facilitation in the views of all of our clients. But secondly, you know, many religious organizations are self-insured. Meaning you know, they are, for all intents and purposes, the insurer. So a government mandate to have the insurer route contraceptives directly to employees would be meaningless for an employer like that. So the government takes that position. It floats these sort of impractical and unhelpful ideas. But then at the same time, it says, well, no one really knows what's going to come out of this process. You know, everything's on the table, at least it says that, so to speak. And so, you know, the government says, well, we can't prejudge the process, so we have to wait and see. And, you know, unfortunately, from our point of view, two judges have agreed with that. We have sought reconsideration, of course, and may appeal. And we are hopeful that not all judges will agree with those holdings and that we'll get some different outcomes.
Before we go to the first audience question, has the government directly addressed the issue of the self-insured entities and the argument you just laid out?
No, they haven't. In the ANPRM, the advance notice, it simply says, and we'll try to think up something for those people as well. Now, I'm paraphrasing, of course. The government has floated some, I have to call them odd ideas for, you see, with a self-insured employer, The employers like that rely on what's called a third-party administrator to administer their self-insured program. And the government floated in the AMPRM the idea of forcing the third-party administrator to provide the insurance. Well, I believe it's called the Self-Insurance Association of America, filed a comment on the AMPRM and said that would be impossible for a third-party administrator to do, and it might even violate federal law to force a third-party administrator to do something like that. So serious problems with what the government has floated thus far about self-insured entities.
Let's go to our first caller.
Hi, Kyle. This is Patrick Pertil with Gammon & Grange in McLean. We represent a lot of religious nonprofit organizations who are trapped trying to figure out how to navigate the contraceptive mandate. And I just I was wondering if there are two things that you could talk to briefly. The first is with the narrowness of the religious employer exemption, which to me is really striking, in that being a church is not sufficient. As a matter of fact, you need to meet three other criteria.
That's
to
right.
To be a religious employer, being a church just being one of the four. It seems to me that there were real echoes of that in DOJ's argument in the Hosanna-Tabor case, where they argued that you had no ministerial exemption whatsoever. But if there was one, it should only apply to the exclusively religious activities of employees. So it seems to me that there's a real pattern here of trying to narrow or so constrain the sphere of religious employment or religious activity outside of essentially the church setting. And I'm wondering if you're seeing that pattern anywhere else. And the other question I'd love to hear you talk a little bit about is, I understand the ripeness and standing issues that everyone's running into. Are you recommending, or do you have any thoughts that you would recommend of what steps a potential plaintiff could make to make themselves put themselves on as strong a footing as possible going forward? I know that some organizations have dropped health care entirely before going into litigation, and I'll just back off now and let you address those.
Okay, thanks. Those are both very good questions. The first we've given a great deal of thought to, because the Beckett Fund handled the Hosanna-Tabor case. And the question goes to, is the federal government take unusually narrow view of what constitutes a religious activity or a religious person or religious organization? The Hosanna-Tabor case, of those of you in the audience who are not familiar with that case, that's a case about the ministerial exception to employment discrimination. And the Supreme Court took that case to address that exemption, that exception for ministerial employees, essentially asking whether an employer, if they dismiss a minister or hire a minister for that matter, are they going to be subject to a employment discrimination lawsuit where the lawsuit is going to be able to inquire into, you know, the theological rationales for the hiring decision. Every court of appeals to have addressed that question said, yes, there is an exception. There must be an exception for the hiring or dismissal of certain ministerial employees. And it had been developing for 40 years, and the Supreme Court finally took a case to sort of figure out the contours of that exception and whether it existed. And the administration, through the Solicitor General's office, took a striking position that there was no such thing as a ministerial exception, and that the religion clauses of the First Amendment really said nothing to a church's decision about who was going to lead the flock, essentially. This didn't go over well in the Supreme Court. This position lost 9-0. The court said, well, of course there's an exception rooted in the Free Exercise Clause and the Establishment Clause that keeps the government out of certain kinds of decision-making of churches and religious organizations. Justice Kagan, from the bench, pronounced the government's position, quote, amazing, and she then joined a concurrence with Justice Alito, you know, sort of outlining a very strong position for a robust ministerial exception. So the question was, you know, is a religious employer exemption here part of the pattern? Well, we can't read the government's mind, of course, but it certainly seems curious that the government took an extraordinarily narrow view of the ministerial exception in Hosanna-Tabor, and said, as the question said, you know, it would apply if it exists to only the exclusively religious activities of an employer. And that drew the question from the Chief Justice, or the comment from the Chief Justice in his majority opinion, that, you know, such a person doesn't exist. There is nobody who works for a religious organization who has exclusively religious activities. I mean, not even the Pope has exclusively religious activities. And so the religious employer exemption does seem sort of related to that, taking this exceedingly narrow view of what you have to do to constitute yourself a religious employer. As far as a pattern, I mean, I might point to something that I've been reading about recently, which is the National Labor Relations Board view of what constitutes a religious employer for purposes of applying rules on unionization. And the NLRB, we're not handling any of those cases, but the NLRB seems to be taking an exceedingly narrow view of what constitutes a religious organization, and seems to be taking the view with respect to Catholic universities that it can sort of determine for itself how religious they are, which creates all sorts of problems with the Establishment Clause and the Free Exercise Clause. So that's sort of a brief response there. You know, I have to say the second question was, what can a plaintiff do to sort of constitute itself and put itself in the best position for purposes of the standing and rightness argument that the government is making? You know, let me just speak generally about that. I mean, what the government is saying is that there's no real injury. There's no clearly impending injury if you have the advantage of the safe harbor, because the injury is put out there for a year. And at the same time, the government is attempting to fix it, to fix the mandate during that year. Now, what we have said to courts on this, and so this might be an indication of what we think a good plaintiff would look like, is, you know, the safe harbor does not relieve a plaintiff of the danger of private enforcement actions by its own plan participants, its own employees under ERISA. So, for instance, Belmont Abbey, which is a Catholic college in North Carolina, Belmont Abbey has already suffered lawsuits by its employees and EEOC actions in the past based on its decisions not to offer contraceptive coverage. So we think, although it hasn't gained traction yet, but we hope it will, we think a plaintiff who has already been subject to private lawsuits based on its health care offerings would be a good plaintiff to sort of refute this argument that there's no present injury from the mandate. Because after all, even with the safe harbor, the mandate is still applicable to the organization during the safe harbor period. So a plaintiff that can show present effects of a mandate, notwithstanding the fact that the government is not enforcing it, would be a good candidate.
While we're waiting to see if there's another question, Kyle, let me take you back to what you mentioned as some shifting litigation strategy on the part of the government. I wonder if you want to say more about that. Are you heartened by that? Do you take that as a sign that they're struggling to formulate a defense of their policy? And I wonder if you want to draw any comparisons to what some people describe as a shifting litigation strategy in the Affordable Care Act case.
Well, sure. So, again, I'm not able to read the government's mind. You know, they may be hanging back going, we have wonderful defenses, wonderful justifications for the mandate, and we just can't wait to spring them upon the plaintiffs in these cases. However, appearances are to the contrary. The government has not been in a hurry to get to the merits of these cases. I mean, let's take Wheaton, for example. That's the most recent decision. You know, Wheaton was an interesting case. It still is an interesting case. Because, you know, Wheaton is a, you know, devoutly evangelical Christian school, and they don't cover abortion, they don't cover anything like that in their health care. But during a review of their health insurance policies in 2011, they discovered that, you know, inadvertently, without their knowledge, some coverage for emergency contraceptive had been placed in their health plan. And we don't need to get into details of how that happened, of course, but, you know, those of you who have worked with insurance companies or reviewed insurance coverage, you know how these things can happen. So when Wheaton discovered that in 2011, it immediately began to exclude this from its policies, but it took some time. It was a complicated undertaking, given some complications with Illinois law. And so Wheaton was only able to finally exclude those after the deadline for the safe harbor had passed, which was in February of this year. And so under the clear terms of the safe harbor, Wheaton couldn't qualify and couldn't sign a certification that it qualified, and, you know, was basically in the position of, we can't qualify, so the mandate's going to hit us in January. We need preliminary injunctive relief. The government's response to that was to say, oh, no, we think that you actually do qualify for the safe harbor, but in order to clarify that, we're going to come out with some new guidance. And it from our point of view, rushed through some new guidance, published the new guidance the day before our opposition to their motion to dismiss was filed, and sort of magically made the safe harbor include Wheaton. Now, you know, to a certain extent, Wheaton's grateful for that. I mean, Wheaton now has some measure of protection and is able to certify that it qualifies for the safe harbor. By the other token, let's just say it doesn't advertise the government's eagerness to get into court on the merits of the mandate. You know, as far as the shifting, there's probably a lot you can say about the government shifting positions in the Affordable Care Act case. I was involved somewhat in that case back when I was in the Louisiana Attorney General's office. Louisiana was one of the original plaintiffs in that case. As far as the safe harbor in these cases go, it's very interesting because in the individual mandate cases, the government was saying, look, initially in the district court in Florida, the government said the individual mandate is not going to hit people until 2014, therefore no standing and no ripeness. And the district judge, Judge Vinson, in that case, rejected that argument out of hand and said just simply delaying the onset of an injury is not enough to defeat standing and to make the case unripe. And the government abandoned that argument and essentially admitted on appeal in the 11th Circuit and in the U.S. Supreme Court that the individual plaintiffs in that case had standing, notwithstanding the 2014 due date. In the HHS mandate cases, the government made the identical argument with respect to the safe harbor and said, we have pushed out the due date for the enforcement of the mandate out to, in some cases, 2014 or late 2013, and therefore you don't have standing, you don't have ripeness. And we pointed out to the court, hey, the government made the same argument in the individual mandate cases, and it failed, and it even conceded that on appeal. And, you know, the government, from our point of view, didn't have a great response to that. The only difference is the government was able to put into place this sort of proposed rulemaking that promises a fix. And as I said, two district judges have agreed with the government that makes the lawsuits not ripe.
Very good. Let's turn back to the audience now. It looks like we've got a couple more questions.
This is Bob Davis in Maine, not an attorney. But you've made reference several times to the government moving the goalposts,
right,
making the target extremely difficult to zero in on. That seems like a very poor way to run a legal system. But it's one thing for Congress to try to exempt certain things from coming under the jurisdiction of a law. But when this is passed on to administrative agencies, how do you avoid problems with equal protection, unconstitutional delegation of legislative power, and making the entire process arbitrary and capricious?
Well, that's a great question, Bob. And we've certainly brought claims under the Administrative Procedures Act alleging exactly those things, arbitrary and capricious, regulation in violation of law. I would add, though, that to your comment, that the religious employer exemption was not passed by Congress. Religious employer exemption was a creature of regulation as well. And it creates all sorts of problems with favoritism and equal protection. Specifically, that is why plaintiffs in these cases have brought claims under the Establishment Clause, because the government is essentially picking and choosing which religious entities it deems religious enough to have a conscience objection. If a church primarily serves people who agree with it, with its religious tenets, then it does. But if it can't say that, if it says, well, say I'm a soup kitchen or something, and it can't really say that it primarily serves people of its own faith, it serves anybody. You know, we've talked to religious groups who say, well, I couldn't agree to that requirement even if it was a factual matter true, because my faith says that I have to serve everybody. So if you serve everybody, the government has said through this religious employer exemption that you don't deserve the protections of the exemption. You don't have the same status as far as a conscience objection. And, you know, that seems to us and to other plaintiffs to violate just a really basic norm of the Establishment Clause, in that the government can't pick and choose favored religious groups So, yeah, it creates all sorts of problems of favoritism and others.
I have a follow-up if you have a moment.
Sure. Go ahead.
Well, the essence of the problem seems to be the extraordinary amount of power that's given to the administrative agencies. And how did that ever become so broad? It started out, it seems to me, as a rather more technical thing where the agencies could fill in the details if something, you know, a comma was out of place or something, you know, very minor was involved. How did it become virtually a grant to legislate?
I'm afraid I'm going to have to sort of give you the conventional answer. Not being an expert on administrative law, my sense is that there's a very long and complex story behind sort of the aggrandizement of the administrative state. It's just happened over time, and you know, it's my sense is it's very, very difficult to make a non-delegation argument. So it's in many ways it's a fait accompli, but I agree with you that it's very disturbing, and those who are more expert in administrative law than I am can could give you a much more detailed answer about how that happened.
Thank you very much.
I won't try here though. Thanks.
Perhaps a topic for an upcoming telephone conference call. Let's go to our next caller.
Hi, this is Jim Gioli and Mark Stern at Burke Warren McKay and Saratella in Chicago. We represent a number of religious institutions, and we were just wondering, in follow-up to the Wheaton case, given that the government did in fact change its position by modifying the safe harbor, do you feel that you're the prevailing party, and is there any intention to seek attorney's fees on that basis?
We haven't made that decision yet. I think that's a very interesting suggestion. I mean, we have to carefully consider that. All I can say is that certainly Wheaton has, up to this point, gained something very significant by the litigation. The certification that the government was asking it to sign before the lawsuit was brought, Wheaton simply could not do it without lying to the government. It was very clear. And the government changed the terms of that certification in order, you know, so that Wheaton could sign it. Of course, it applies to more organizations than only Wheaton. But at the same time, the government said, and has said in open court, we haven't changed anything. We haven't actually changed it, implicitly saying that Wheaton, I suppose it means that Wheaton could have signed it before. I don't know if the government would have taken that position. But from Wheaton's point of view, Wheaton has gained something very, very significant in the case. So that's an intriguing suggestion.
Go to the next question.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. How about making the argument, even though it has no chance at all of being accepted, that Congress has no constitutional authority whatsoever to legislate this entire area? Instead of simply acquiescing in the long line of wrong precedents going all the way back to McCullough, can't we just once in a while make the argument that shows that we do not accept those precedents, that they are wrong, that we will not let go into the night pretending that they are valid?
Well, you know, I have to say I may be very friendly philosophically to making arguments like that. From our point of view, I can speak as someone representing the plaintiffs, some of the plaintiffs in these cases. What we want to do in these cases is zero in on the most obvious defects in the mandate. There are surely a whole universe of defects that one could point to. But zeroing in on why, on making it as easy as possible for a court to invalidate the mandate really led us to a lot, you know, the First Amendment, obviously, but to the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which is a very powerful law. I mean, so, you know, I this is probably not a satisfying answer to you, but in representing the plaintiffs, we want to zero in on really where we feel that the mandate is the weakest. That is not to say that there aren't other arguments to be made against the regulation and the legislation more generally, but we zeroed in on where we feel that it's weakest, and where it's weakest in our view is just a gross violation of religious liberty. It's unprecedented for the federal government to say, you must do this, or this thing that violates your faith, or we will fine you. It's a really obvious violation of religious liberty.
We have one more question from the audience, then our lines are open.
This is Paul Burgess, not to beat it to death, but to go back to the Wheaton case.
Yeah.
I'm interested in these new guidelines. I was, well, first of all, I'm curious, have they published these new guidelines? Are they out there? And secondly, does it include something more than just the educational, like you were pointing out, specific to the Wheaton case?
No, it does. The government published the new guidance on the HHS website. It was done in response to our lawsuit, so we were aware of it very early. But the new guidance is published on the website, and what the new guidance says, it expands the safe harbor in two ways. It says, I'll paraphrase because it's a bunch of very complex regulatory language, but it says if the objection of an organization was not to all contraceptives but only to a subset of contraceptives, so the evangelical plaintiff, for instance, that doesn't object to all contraceptives but only to certain ones that it believes cause an abortion, the revised guidance makes it clear that that entity can take advantage of the safe harbor. That was not clear at all before. As a matter of fact, the language was directly to the contrary. The second one, which is even more sort of situation-specific, but it may apply to a number of organizations, is that if an organization covered any contraceptives by error before, so covered something that it didn't want to cover by error previous to the safe harbor going into effect, and then made some kind of effort to get it out, but was unable to get it out until after the safe harbor deadline, then the safe harbor is open to it. And if that sounds convoluted, it is. If you look at the language in the guidance, it's very, very confusing. The idea is to sort of create a no harm, no foul sort of exception to the safe harbor where, well, you didn't mean to. When you realize it, you tried to get them out, and you just didn't do it in time. So from our point of view, it looked like it was tailored to the Wheaton situation. I suspect that there are others, maybe many other organizations in that position. But that's how the guidance is now phrased, with the government on top of all of it claiming that it didn't change the meaning of the guidance, which strikes us as difficult to defend that position.
Kyle, it looks like we've got yet another question. Let's go to that next question.
Kyle, this is Patrick Pertil again. I'm sorry to
Hi.
Monopolize
yeah.
The discussion, but I just wanted to go back. You were talking about when we were talking about plaintiffs putting themselves in the best possible position.
Right.
You were discussing present harm. It seems to me that even under the expanded safe harbor definition that HRSA came out with on the 15th, there are still plenty of organizations that are discovering that they still can't hit the certification form unless you think HHS is somehow offering some type of blanket get-out-of-jail-free card for 1 year to push this off, at least past, say, perhaps November. Because it seems to me that an organization that has conscience objections to the emergency contraceptive family that's FDA approved, if they didn't discover, and I'm finding many organizations that didn't discover this prior to February 10th, they've taken no action. They took no action prior to February 10th, and they did cover a subset. So the same subset language, the certification form, kind of traps them. Do you think that are organizations in that position in a position to show that present harm you were alluding to earlier?
Well, look, I mean, you're obviously looking at the new certification. I'm looking at it right here on my desk right now. It says the new certification, which was added, which some of our lawyers noted is even in a different font than the original certification, says, I certify that the organization took some action before February 10th, 2012, to try to exclude from the coverage, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So
right.
by the terms of the new certification, if you didn't realize it, therefore you couldn't have taken any action before it, and therefore it would seem that the certification doesn't apply. At the risk of offering a legal opinion, I'm just reading the language there and saying that it doesn't seem to apply. Of course, I have to say, by way of caution, the original certification was very clearly stated, I thought, and would clearly not apply to somebody who covered some but not all, didn't want to cover some but not all contraceptives, or that covered those contraceptives after February 10th, and the government was able to change it. Can the government just change it again? Well, I don't see why not.
Got
maybe
it.
At some point a court will run out of patience with it. the certification now says what it says, and, you know, but it's obviously subject to change.
Right. I guess that's fair enough. If they're willing to, you know, if they're willing to pull the rug out one time, there'd be nothing that would prevent it a second.
Yeah. And I have to say, you know, as somebody who represents these people, we did not view this as a cute argument, like, you know, an argument that we were just playing games with language. The government took a definitive position about this safe harbor. Presumably, they had thought about it and made a policy decision that we're going to safe harbor certain organizations but not others, and there were requirements. And we took the government at its word and said, well, look, this plaintiff is in a position where it cannot take advantage of it. So, you know, that's but we see what happens. So, we'll, you know, the Whedon case, I should add, is not over, and we're considering what, you know, our further options are at this point.
We've got a few minutes left, so let's turn to this question.
This is Matt McReynolds, the Pacific Justice Institute. I haven't followed all of the cases super closely, so my question is whether looking across all the different lawsuits that are out there on this by different organizations, different plaintiffs, if you've noticed any major variations in theories of the case or claims, strategies, or if it seems to be mostly minor variations in the basic approach.
That's a good question. I have to say I have seen minor variations. I see a large amount of unanimity across the different cases as far as the arguments that are being made. I mean, we see arguments under free exercise, which are essentially that the mandate is not a generally applicable law because of all the exceptions and exemptions in it. We see claims under the Establishment Clause because of this religious favoritism point that I talked about. We see claims on the Free Speech Clause because the mandate not only includes the drugs, but also includes patient education and counseling about the drugs. And we see claims under RFRA, under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which is a statutory claim, although it's a very powerful claim. And we also see APA claims. So I haven't seen notable variations. It's possible that I missed something, but I haven't seen notable variations.
Very good. Well, it looks like we're out of questions. I do want to give you an opportunity to express any final thoughts, Kyle, or wrap up if you'd like to before we adjourn.
Well, no, I just appreciate everyone's attention and good questions. It's a very important issue, and I encourage everyone to keep following it and keep informing themselves about it. Go to our website at beckettfund.org, and we have a great deal of information there that's useful. If you're interested, feel free to contact me if you have any more specific questions or just want to follow up on something that I said. But I appreciate your time, and this has been a lot of fun. Thanks.
Very good. Again, for those of you who joined us late and some people had difficulty joining the call, if you were among them, we've recorded this call and we'll be posting it on our website, the Federalist Society's website, as a podcast. Feel free to download that and listen from the beginning. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I do want to thank you, Kyle Duncan, for joining us today. And invite the rest of you to visit our website for a schedule of upcoming Teleforum conference calls. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.